World News Today, brought to you by the Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations, as well as leading news centers of our own country, CBS correspondents are waiting to bring you a complete report from the world's political and battlefronts. But first, here's Doug Edwards.
The new Allied landings on the west coast of Italy appear to have put the Germans into a pretty tough spot. Columbia's shortwave listening station has heard the British radio report that the Germans are moving large forces back from the Fifth Army front towards Rome. Russian troops are driving toward key rail junctions near Leningrad, threatening to cut all German supply lines in the north. The Navy has just announced that American planes have carried out two new raids on the big Jap base at Paramashiro in the Kuril Islands. In the South Pacific, the Australians have opened a drive to clear the Japs from the northern New Guinea coast and are now within 40 miles of Madang. For our first news report from overseas, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Algiers. Winston Burdett reporting.
It is now solidly established. Here are the main facts about the Allied invasion south of Rome, which in its second day is making good headway against a surprise German army. American and British forces have struck several miles inland from the western beaches and are now jabbing toward the first highway leading from Rome to the main Fifth Army front. This highway roughly parallels the Italian west coast and is some 12 to 15 miles inland. To isolate this battle zone and to prevent large-scale reinforcements from getting there, fortresses have been blasting road and rail points between Rome and the beachhead. To prevent the Germans from switching fresh Panzer Grenadier divisions from their mountain line to the beaches, liberators have pounded coastal routes linking the two fronts. Yesterday, Allied squadrons outflew the Luftwaffe by 1,300 sorties to 100 over the invasion front alone. The chief question is, from what direction will the German command call up reinforcements to meet the Allied landing? Three German divisions were recently pulled down from the Rome area to the Fifth Army front. Three highly trained and completely motorized Panzer Grenadier divisions. Our invasion caught the Germans at the very time they were organizing a counteroffensive along the line of the Rapidore and Garigliano rivers. The three fresh divisions are either in that line today or in reserve just behind it. In either case, our invasion forces are behind them, many miles behind them up the west coast. A major German counterattack against our landing is bound to come. All the power of our heavy bombers cannot prevent that counterattack. Somewhere between the two Italian fronts, the Germans have three re-equipped divisions. We have gone around them, but the feebleness of the opposition so far is certainly no measure of the fierceness of the battles to come. Reporting from advanced headquarters in Italy, CBS correspondent Farnsworth Farrell says that everybody in this invasion realizes he has been lucky at the start and that it will take plenty of hard fighting to defend and exploit our gains. But it was not just luck, Farrell adds. Clever strategy aimed our invasion much further north than the Germans expected. Our offensive on the main Fifth Army front sucked in most of the German divisions in the area, and it's that much harder for the enemy to make a quick answer to the new threat. I return you now to New York.
More news in just a moment, but first here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
Berlin's war industries have been almost totally destroyed by recent Allied bombings. And radio underground, radio perhaps built by Admiral, has played an important role in these devastating raids. The Nazis have moved whole munitions plants practically overnight to save them from destruction. But secret radio has helped to keep the Allies informed about these moves and their new locations. In Germany, as in all the occupied countries, the underground movement is a chief source of worry to Hitler and his henchmen. They have decreed the death penalty for listening to Allied broadcasts or for anyone found with a sending set in his possession. But still, at the risk of their very lives, these patriots continue to send out vital information by radio. When the war ends and our enemies have unconditionally surrendered, there will be many amazing facts to tell of radio's part in the war. Admiral Corporation, before the war, was the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonograph combinations with automatic record changers. This vast productive power is, of course, now directed toward our nation's war effort. But Admiral is planning for the day when peace comes. Then, the lessons learned in war will be invaluable in building your new and better Admiral, America's Smart Set. Now, here once again for Admiral Radio is Doug Edwards.
For a summary of the news you heard direct from Algiers a few moments ago, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
The German troops in Italy are certainly gathering their power for a counterattack against the Anglo-American landing forces who went ashore southwest of Rome early yesterday morning. The point is that they haven't launched the attack yet. The most favorable period for a counterattack against a landing force is, of course, when the defender can catch the advance elements of the landing force, as the military term has it, astride of the beach. That is, with a scattering of infantry elements and perhaps a few machine guns ashore, which can be wiped out by a vigorous attack of all the defending forces, especially armored troops supported by artillery. If this can be done before the landing forces can get their own artillery and heavy supporting weapons ashore, before they can land tanks and armored cars to protect them, and heavy engineer equipment with which to dig in, there's a good chance of defeating them. But in opposing a landing, the first few hours are of great importance. Give a strong and well-commanded landing force these first few hours undisturbed, and it will establish itself a beachhead, which will have all the defensive power of a fortress. Such a beachhead may well be deep and broad enough to protect the landing beaches from enemy artillery fire. And if this is so, then the first stage of the landing operation has been successfully completed. And this appears to be the case in central Italy today. After that, it's a question of hard fighting, of slugging it out, with a great advantage on the side of the attacker because of his air superiority. We had tough luck at Salerno, where we had ran right into enemy prepared positions. Southwest of Rome, we appear to have established our beachheads firmly. The Germans have missed their first and greatest opportunity to throw us out, and in their present desperate strategical condition, the missing of opportunities is a luxury which the German commander in Italy cannot afford.
That was Major George Fielding Elliott. And now for the news from London and an interview with Britain's First Lord of the Admiralty, A.V. Alexander, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS London, Larry Lesser reporting.
London's spirits rose with the news that British and American troops are deepening and broadening their bridgehead south of Rome. But no amphibious attack can ever catch the enemy completely by surprise, because the marshaling of invasion barges cannot be concealed from the prying eyes of enemy reconnaissance planes. So London waits to see what counteraction the Germans are able to take now in Italy. Meanwhile, it's to be remembered that while Allied foot soldiers are now doing the job in Italy, it was the Navy that brought them there. And tonight you'll hear a naval commentary by Britain's First Lord of the Admiralty, Mr. A.V. Alexander.
After the defeat of his attempt to destroy us in 1940, the enemy turned his vast resources against our sea communications. In 1941 and 42, this was as deadly a menace as the Luftwaffe had been in 1940. The more dramatic character of the air battle must not obscure this equally decisive encounter, spread out longer in time and wider in space, and compounded of many diverse incidents. The enemy employed every possible weapon, his main one being the U-boat. These small craft could be built in great numbers, and soon an enormous fleet was at sea, patrolling hundreds of miles of ocean. They had the advantage of operating on the flank of our sea communications and the support of long-range shore-based aircraft. The Germans also used aircraft to attack our shipping and claimed many victims before we could provide adequate defense. An intensive campaign of mine-laying around our coasts was aimed at those ships which successfully crossed the Atlantic, and occasionally German surface ships slipped out into the Atlantic. In the Mediterranean, the Italian fleet contained resources which would have been invaluable elsewhere. Finally, the Japanese intervened and were able to deploy very large forces of ships and aircraft. But all this must be viewed as one decisive struggle with occasional dramatic episodes, such as the sinking of the Graspei and the Bismarck. But with the Navy steaming, fighting, carrying, rescuing in all the seven seas, every day and night, but with little publicity. When we stood alone, our men achieved wonders with their scanty material. The entry of Russia imposed an additional heavy obligation of the convoys. Our people worked night and day to give us weapons. And these, together with your splendid leasemen help, particularly merchant ships, began to redress the balance. 1942 saw two decisive events at sea. First, the checking of the Japanese fleet. Second, the restoration of our power in the Mediterranean. By Christmas, the position was being held, but no more. 1943 saw more decisive events. The figures of merchant ship losses were strikingly reduced, and the destruction of U-boats greatly increased, whilst the amount of tonnage constructed became much greater than that being sunk. Then came the surrender of the Italian fleet, and the opening of the Mediterranean followed by the damage to the Tirpitz and the sinking of the Scharnhorst. We are now definitely on top at sea. But tremendous tasks lie ahead. The liberation of Europe will impose colossal responsibilities on the British and American navies and merchant services, far outstripping even the unprecedented great combined operations for the capture of North Africa and Sicily, which required the largest armada in world history and the recent and present assaults in Italy. Every ship of the enormous number being turned out by the United Nations, both naval and merchant, will be needed. There will be absolutely nothing to spare. We shall indeed be hard put to it to provide every ship we need, and every increase in production that can be achieved now is of the utmost value. We are about to gird on our sword for the final encounter in Europe. On its temper and its weight depends our victory. The armorer is now giving the weapon its finishing touches, and the finishing touches are the most important. The navies will be there.
Thank you, Mr. Alexander. We return you now to CBS, New York.
For a direct report from the Pacific War Zone, Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS Australia. William J. Dunn reporting.
It's just a few minutes before dawn in the Southwest Pacific. In New Britain and the Huon Peninsula, our night patrols are creeping back to their bases after hours of exploring enemy positions.
Our naval patrol craft are concluding their night's chore of hunting out and harassing enemy barges and supply boats.
From their New Guinea bases, our heavy and medium bombers are off for dawn attacks on enemy positions, and fighter pilots are getting their last-minute instructions before leaving on a sorting mission. The black cats are turning back from their long hours of aerial patrolling enemy waters far to the north, possibly with news of enemy ships which may be singled out for attack later in the day. The enemy, too, is tensing in all his forward areas, for experience has taught him that this is the time when Allied blows often fall, blows of greater or less intensity. It wouldn't be correct say that the Southwest Pacific is waking up as dawn nears, for sleep in the combat areas is not measured by the sun. It's a luxury enjoyed whenever there's nothing more important to do, whether by night or by day. But the area is stirring right now to its greatest period of daily activity. Americans, Australians, and Japanese will die down here within the next hour. On any of the great airfields of the Southwest Pacific, the hour just before daybreak is usually the most interesting of the 24. In numberless revetments and dispersal phase scattered throughout the area, crews are hard at work under guarded lights, loading bomb bays, checking guns, fueling, and making last-minute adjustments to the great shadowy bombers. Inside the operations base, a large group of serious young men, pilots, navigators, bombardiers, fluster about their chief and his endless supply of maps and photographs, taking their final briefing, listening intently, asking and answering questions designed to eliminate as far as possible the element of human error. They'll be away before dawn breaks on some new mission of destruction to enemy positions or support of their ground troops. And for most of them, their day's work will be over by noon. I imagine that most of you folks back home are used to thinking of the Southwest Pacific in terms of your own clock, although you are aware of the difference. The next time your watch tells you that it's mid-afternoon on America's eastern seaboard, just remind yourself that this hour is the start of a new day down in this part of the world. The hour when your sons, brothers, and husbands in the Southwest Pacific are likely to be launching their greatest adventure. This is William J. Dunn in Australia. I return you to CBS, New York.
Admiral Radio takes you next to CBS Washington. Don Pryor reporting.
Washington is fascinated but a little bit puzzled about the new War Refugee Board established last night by the President. A White House statement said Mr. Roosevelt intends to get the cooperation of all the United Nations in his plan to rescue victims of Nazi oppression from Europe. Special State Department attachés will be stationed in spots where they can help. It looks like the beginning on an official basis of a gigantic underground railroad, but just how it's to be accomplished is left up to the board. When you think of Liberator bombers, you naturally think of the Army. But here's a Navy pilot just back from Guadalcanal, where for the last 6 months he has been flying Liberators right in the Japs' backyard. He's Lieutenant Commander Gordon Fowler, USN, until a few weeks ago the commander of a squadron of Navy heavy bombers based at Henderson Field. How does the Navy use Liberators, Commander Fowler, for bombing?
Sometimes. Now and then we went out on bombing missions with the Army. But our primary job was long-range search or patrol.
Looking for the Jap fleet, I suppose.
Among other things, yes. Our job was just to watch the Japs in general in that area and see what they were doing.
Well, did your planes go out in groups or alone?
No, each plane went alone. That South Pacific is a pretty big place, and we had a lot of territory to cover. We flew north as far as Nauru. That's a little island southwest of Tarawa. And northwest as far as Kavieng, New Ireland.
Well, I should think individual planes out there would be pretty vulnerable.
They are, particularly since our patrol area and the Japs overlapped. We ran into them every now and then.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, just after Commander Fowler returned, he was decorated with a Distinguished Flying Cross. And the citation mentioned that he had destroyed one twin-engine Jap bomber, shot down one Japanese fighter and damaged another, and that he damaged and possibly sank a Japanese tanker. Did you just happen to run into all of those?
Yes. The bomber was a Jap patrol plane, something like our B-26. Both of us came out of a rain squall about the same time. He was faster than we were and tried to run for home. But we knocked out one of his engines at long range and then closed in on him. He wasn't very smart. He didn't even try to duck back into the clouds.
Did he try to shoot it out with you?
Oh, yes. He did a lot of shooting, but he didn't hit us. In fact, in all the time I was out there, I didn't get a single bullet hole in any plane I flew.
Well, you must have carried a rabbit's foot. That's really remarkable because Commander Fowler has seen about as much of the Pacific War as any one man could see. He started in Manila just after the war began, flew all through the early phase of the war, and then spent 6 months in Guadalcanal and never got a bullet hole in a plane. How about those Japanese fighters, Commander?
That happened one day when we were reconnoitering Nauru. We went in just off the water until we saw a Jap fighter take off. Then we climbed into the clouds. Eventually, five of them were in the air, and we scooted for home, hopping in and out of the clouds for all the protection we could get. One of them came up under us just as we came out of a cloud. My belly gunner gave him a burst, and he exploded. Then another came in from the side, and the waist gunner took care of him. He saw pieces of it fly off the Zero, but we didn't see it crash.
That DFC citation also mentioned that you led a bombing raid over a fortified enemy airfield. How about that?
We knocked out the Jap field at Buka as part of the preparation for the invasion of Bougainville.
Still no damage?
Not a bit.
How about life on Guadalcanal, Commander?
By the time I got there, it was pretty civilized. They even had traffic cops and ice cream. Of course, I was there in the dry season when it was comparatively cool and the mosquitoes weren't too bad.
What would you say they need down there now, most urgently?
Well, I'm not in a position to say with any authority. I know we need a lot more pilots. The ones we have are a lot better than the Japs. That's why our losses down there are so small. But we need more of them. These V-5 youngsters are doing a grand job out there.
Well, that was Lieutenant Commander Gordon Fowler, just recently back from Guadalcanal. I return you to Admiral Radio in New York.
Moscow dispatches report that Red Army troops are moving southwest and southeast of Leningrad today in an encircling move around German forces south of the city and are threatening to cut off their last escape routes by rail. The enemy is concentrated in an area north of the Magat at Krasnogvardaysk Railroad, which cuts across all six lines radiating from Leningrad. Columbia correspondent Bill Downs has just returned to this country after a year in the Soviet Union, and he's here in the studio with us today. How does the present battle of Russia look to you, Bill?
Well, second-guessing the Red Army is dangerous business, even when you're in Moscow, Doug. Right now, of course, the battle in the north is a big story.
Well, reports from Russia stress the importance of railroads leading into Leningrad. For example, with the capture of the rail junction of Magar, we're told that the main trunk line into the city has been freed for traffic.
Undoubtedly, the freeing of this trunk line between Moscow and Leningrad is of primary importance. But for the past 6 months, there has been rail connection between the two cities. It was a roundabout route which entered Leningrad through the Russian-held corridor northeast of the city. Civilians with necessary permission have been riding sleeping cars between Moscow and Leningrad all fall and winter. This line was under Finnish and German artillery fire, but scores of trains got through. It was this rail line that carried much of the heavy equipment into Leningrad, which has made the present offensive possible. Building of this auxiliary line under fire is a great tribute to Red Army engineers.
How long do you think it will take for the Russians to restore the main Leningrad to Moscow trunk line?
Well, that depends. When the Germans tear up a railroad, they do the job completely, uprooting ties and even putting special explosives under each individual rail to blow chunks out of them. But right now, the Russian offensive is a rolling on American wheels.
What do you mean by that, Bill?
There are probably more American trucks and jeeps and weapon carriers in Russia than any other country outside the United States. Supplies for the Stalingrad victory were largely carried on American ten-wheelers, which can negotiate the deep Russian snow. It was the same at Oryol in Belgorod last summer, and again at Kiev, where these American trucks were able to cope with Ukrainian mud. Now are they doing another winter job around Leningrad. Tens of thousands of American trucks form the last vital link between the supply centers and the front line. The Russians love them, and they're using them well.
But how do the Russian drivers keep this transport rolling in the sub-zero weather there?
Well, you'd have to see it to believe it. Russian drivers don't waste time with radiator alcohol or antifreeze mixtures. Every time they start a truck, they drain the radiator. When they want to start it up again, they build a fire.
What do you mean, build a fire?
Well, they take some wood and paper and crawl into the truck and build a bonfire under the motor. Why they don't burn up half their transport, I don't know, but it works. When the fire heats up the engine, they start it up and keep it running. Then they put water in the radiator and drive until they have to stop again. It might not be the best way of handling a truck, but that's the way American trucks are carrying the stuff to the Red Army today outside Leningrad. It's a perfect example of two guys getting together to lick Hitler. Joe Doakes in Detroit is doing one grand job building those trucks. And Joe Doakesky, the Russian truck driver on the Leningrad front, is putting this labor to good use. That's the kind of war it is.
Thanks, Bill Downs. And now once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
With all new radio equipment headed for the fighting fronts, your busy Admiral dealer is literally swamped with repair work these days, and it's unfair to ask him to waste valuable time making a service call at your home for some minor adjustment that you might easily have done yourself. For that reason, Admiral has prepared the Home Checkup Chart, which describes and illustrates 20 things you can do to make a checkup before you call your Admiral serviceman. These are simple, easy-to-do adjustments that require no special skill or electrical knowledge. For example, tubes are sometimes jarred loose. Push all of them firmly into their sockets and make certain that all leads are securely on the tube caps. Of course, in the case of a major trouble or a structural failure, your Admiral dealer is the man to contact. His years of experience and his equipment assure the best repair service obtainable. But we suggest you get an Admiral home checkup chart from him and make the home checkup before requesting a service call. Or a copy of Admiral's home checkup chart will be sent you without obligation or cost. Simply write Admiral Radio in care of this station. The appearance of personnel of the armed services on this program does not necessarily constitute an endorsement of our product for the armed services. A warning to parents. Remember, epidemics flourish in wartime. Last year's epidemic of infantile paralysis claimed a terrifying total of victims, a total equaled only twice before in United States records. Thousands of children were crippled. Thousands need continuing treatment for months, maybe years.
Help these children and help guard your own family at the same time. Join now in the fight against infantile paralysis. Fight it by sending every dime and dollar you can spare to President Roosevelt at the White House. Join the March of Dimes today. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by the Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.